It was after midnight before Rider rode back to his godown. He slept only a few hours before Bakshit woke him again. He ate his breakfast of cold, hard dara cakes and pickled salt beef while seated at his desk, working over his journal and cash book by the light of the oil lamps. He felt a sinking sense of dread as he realized how finely drawn were his business affairs. Apart from £600 deposited in the Caro branch of Baring's Bank, almost all his wealth was concentrated in the besieged city. In his warehouse he had over 18 tons of ivory, worth 5 shillings a pound, but only when it reached Cairo. In beleaguered Khartoum it was not worth a sack of durra. The same could be said of the ton and a half of gum arabic, the sap of the acacia tree, which had been dried into sticky black bricks. It was a valuable commodity used in the arts, cosmetics, and printing industries. In Cairo, his stock would sell for several thousand pounds. Then he had 4 large storerooms stacked to the ceiling with dried cattle hides bartered from the pastoral Dinka and Shiluk tribes to the south. Another large room was filled with trade goods, rolls of copper wire, Venetian glass beads, steel axe and hoe heads, hand mirrors, old tower muskets, and kegs of cheap black gunpowder, rolls of calico and Birmingham cotton goods, with all the other trinkets and gewgaws that delighted the rulers of the southern kingdoms and their subjects. In the cages and stockades at the far end of his compound he kept the wild animals and birds that formed an important part of his trading stock. They had been captured in the savannas and forests of Equatoria and brought downriver in his barges and steamer. In the stockades they were rested, tamed, and made familiar with their human keepers. At the same time, the keepers learnt what food and treatment would ensure their survival until they were transported north up the Nile to be auctioned to the dealers and their agents in Cairo and Damascus, and even to Naples and Rome, where prices were considerably higher. In those markets, some of the rarer African species might fetch as much as £100 each. His most valuable possessions were concealed behind the steel door of the strong room, which was hidden by a large Persian wall hanging. More than 100 bags of silver Maria Theresa dollars, that ubiquitous coin of the Middle East, minted with the portrait of the buxom Queen of Hungary and Bohemia. This was the only coinage acceptable to the Abyssinians in their mountainous kingdom, and his other more sophisticated trading partners, such as the Muteza in Buganda, the Hadendawa and the Saar of the eastern deserts. At the moment there would be little trading with the emirs of these desert Arab tribes. Almost all had gone over en masse to join the Mahdi's jihad. He smiled sardonically in the lamplight. I wonder if the Mahdi might be open to an offer of Maria Theresa dollars, he thought. But I expect not. I hear he has already accumulated over £1 million in plunder. In the strong room, alongside the canvas bags of dollars, were even greater treasures. 50 sacks of durra corn, a couple of dozen boxes of Cuban cheroots, 6 cases of Hind cognac, and £50 of Abyssinian coffee. Chinese Gordon is shooting hoarders. I hope he offers me a last cheroot and a blindfold, he mused. Then he became deadly serious again. Before Gordon had commandeered the intrepid Ibis, Ryder had made plans to move as much as possible of his stock and stores downriver to Cairo. Then he would run the blockade of the river. He had also planned that while he was occupied with this voyage, Bakshit would take the bulkier and less valuable stocks by camel caravan to Abyssinia, and perhaps even to one of the trading ports on the coast of the Red Sea. Although the Mahdi had deployed his armies along the western bank of the White Nile, and the northern bank of the Blue Nile, and was blockading the river, there were still many gaps in his besieging cordon. Principal of these was the broad wedge of open desert between the two rivers, at whose apex stood the city. Only the narrow canal protected this part of the city perimeter, and although General Gordon's men were deepening and widening it, there was nothing beyond. No dervish army, only sand, scrub, and a few stands of acacia thorn, for hundreds of miles. Said Makhtoum, one of the few emirs who had not yet gone over to the dervish, had agreed a price with Ryder to bring his camels close into the city, just out of sight of it, behind a low rocky ridge. There, under Bakshit's supervision, he would load the cargo and smuggle it over the Sudanese border to one of Ryder's trading stations in the foothills of the Abyssinian Mountains. All of those plans must now go by the board. He would be forced to leave all his possessions in the beleaguered city, taking only a boatload of refugees with him. "Damn General Bloody Chinese Bloody Gordon," he said, stood up abruptly and moved around the room. Apart from the cabin of the intrepid Ibis, this was his only permanent home. His father and his grandfather had been wanderers. From them he had learnt the itinerant lifestyle of the hunter and the African trader. But this go-down was home. It needed only a good woman to make it complete. A sudden image of Rebecca Benbrook opened in his mind. He smiled ruefully. He had a feeling that for no good reason he could fathom, he had burned his bridges in that quarter. He crossed to a pair of massive elephant tusks that were fastened by bronze rings to the stonework of the wall and stroked one of the stained yellow shafts absently. The feeling of the smooth ivory under his fingers was as comforting as a string of worry beads. With a single bullet through the brain, Ryder had killed the mighty bull who had carried these tusks at Karamojo, 1,000 miles south of Khartoum on the Victoria Nile. Still fondling the ivory, he studied the faded photograph in its ebony frame on the near wall. It depicted a family standing in front of an ox wagon in a bleak but unmistakably African landscape. A team of 16 oxen was inspanned, and the black driver stood beside them, ready to crack his long whip and begin the trek towards some nameless destination out there in the blue yonder. In the centre of the picture, Ryder's father sat in the saddle of his favourite mount, a grey gelding he had named Fox. He was a big, powerfully built man, with a full dark beard. He had died so long ago that Ryder could not remember if it was a reasonable likeness. He was holding the 6-year-old Ryder on the pommel of his saddle, with his long, skinny legs dangling. Ryder's mother stood at the horse's head, gazing serenely at the camera. He remembered every detail of her lovely features, and as always when he looked on them, he felt his heart squeezed by the memory. She was holding his sister's hand. Alice was a few years older than Ryder. On the other side of her stood Ryder's elder brother, with one arm protectively round their mother's waist. That day had been Wait Courtney's 16th birthday. He was 10 years older than Ryder, and had been more a father to him than a brother, after their own father had been killed by a wounded buffalo during the course of the journey on which the 5 in the photograph had been about to embark. The last time Ryder Courtney had wept was when he received the telegraph from his sister Alice in London with the terrible news that Waite had been killed by the Zulus on some godforsaken battlefield in South Africa under a hill called Isandlwana, the place of the Little Hand. He had left his widow Ada with 2 sons, Sean and Garrick. Fortunately, they were almost grown men and could take care of her. Ryder sighed and drove these sad thoughts from his mind. He shouted for Bakshit. Although it was still dark, there was much they must do today if they were to be ready to sail before midnight. The 2 men walked past the ivory warehouse to the gate of the animal stockade. Old Ali met them, coughing and grumbling. "O beloved of Allah," Ryder greeted him, "may the wombs of all your beautiful young wives be fruitful, and may their ardour fire your heart and weaken your knees." Ali tried not to grin at this levity, for all 3 of his wives were ancient crones. When a chuckle almost escaped him, he turned it into a cough, then spat a glob of yellow phlegm into the dust. Ali was the keeper of the menagerie, and although he seemed to hate all mankind, he had a magical way with wild creatures. He led Ryder on a tour of the monkey cages. They were all clean, and the water and feed in the dishes was fresh. Ryder reached into the cage of Colobus, and his favourite jumped onto his shoulder, bared his teeth and exposed his fangs. Ryder found the remains of the durra cake from his breakfast in his pocket and fed it to him. He stroked the handsome black-and-white coat as they went on down the row of cages. There were 5 different species of ape, including dog-faced baboons, and 2 young chimpanzees, which were hugely in demand in Europe and Asia, and would find eager buyers in Cairo. They clambered up and hugged Ali round the neck. The youngest sucked his ear as though it was his mother's teat. Ali grumbled at them in soft, loving tones. Beyond the monkeys, there were cages full of birds, from starlings of vivid metallic hues to eagles, huge owls, long-legged storks and hornbills with beaks like great yellow trumpets. "Are you still able to find food for them?" Ryder indicated the carnivorous birds tethered by one leg to their posts. Ali grunted noncommittally, but Bakhshit answered for him. "The rats are the only animals that still thrive in the city. The urchins bring them in for 2 copper coins each." Ali looked at him venomously, for having divulged information that was none of his business. At the far end of the stockade, the antelopes were penned together. Except for the Cape buffalo, who were too aggressive to share with other animals, they were still calves, barely weaned, for young animals were more resilient and travelled better than mature beasts. Ryder had left for last the 2 rare and lovely antelope he had captured on his last expedition. They had lustrous ginger coats with stark white stripes, huge swimming eyes and trumpet-shaped ears, and were also still calves. When fully mature, they would be the size of a pony. Buds bulged out between their ears, which would soon sprout into heavy corkscrew horns. Although the cured hides of the bongo had been described before, no live specimen had ever been offered for sale in Europe as far as Ryder knew. A breeding pair like this would command a prince's ransom. He fed them durra cakes, and they slobbered greedily into his palm. As they walked on, Ryder and Ali discussed how best to maintain a constant supply of fodder to keep their charges nourished and healthy. The bongos were browsing animals, and Ali had discovered that they accepted the foliage of the acacia tree. Al-Maktoum's men regularly brought in camel loads of freshly cut branches from the desert in exchange for handfuls of silver Maria Theresa dollars. "Soon we will have to capture another floating reed island, because if we do not, the other animals will starve," Ali warned lugubriously. He relished being the bearer of worrisome tidings. When rafts of swamp weed and papyrus broke free from the dense masses in the lagoons and channels of the Sud, they were carried downstream on the Nile. Some of the rafts were so extensive and buoyant that often they brought large animals with them from the swamps. Despite the best efforts of the dervish, Ryder and his crew were able to secure these living rafts with long cables and heave them onto the bank. There, gangs of labourers hacked the matted vegetation into manageable blocks and moored them in the moat of the channel. The grasses and reeds remained green until they could be used as fodder. There was scarcely enough daylight for Ryder to finish his preparations to leave Khartoum, and the sun was setting by the time he and Bakhshit left the compound with a string of baggage camels for the old harbour. Jock McCrump had steam up in the boilers of the Intrepid Ibis when they were aboard. Ryder was painfully aware of the spying eyes of the city upon them as they loaded the last bundles of cordwood for the boilers into one of the barges. The sun had been down for 2 hours before they had finished, but the heat of the day still held the city in a sweaty embrace as the moon began to show its upper limb above the eastern horizon and transform the ugly buildings of the city with its pale, romantic rays.